good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us. I think I'm like right between a sneeze. I think I can work my way through it. Yes. Okay. I can work my way through it. Good morning, all. Thank you all for being with us, for joining us, for helping out the lockbox. We need you horribly during this time because we have to make the money to keep the radio station going. It's as simple as that. And it's great to have Ray back with Sarah and hear them make the case this morning. They'll be making that case again at 11:30 this morning, but you can give at any time in between, and really any time, WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. We have volunteers standing by as we speak. Pause. Speaking of volunteers, we are looking for volunteers to join us for the fund drive. It all begins June 1st. That is a week from this coming Monday. All you have to do is go to wamc.org/volunteer to sign up. I don't think I'm telling tales out of school, but things in the fundraising world a tad slower in the summer than they are other times of the year. So we really, really need help with volunteers during this time. It also doesn't help that it has been winter up until yesterday, and then we got a day of summer, and now this apparently is going back, but we'll see how all that goes. If you can be a volunteer and help us, and whether you've been a volunteer before, and we live on the volunteers, it's just an amazing group of people who have helped us so much. If you've never done it, it's really fun. We're all in the room together. We do the, during the fund drive, we do the pitching from there. It's really great fun, and I think you'll enjoy it. You can do as little or as much as you want. There are people who come here at 6 in the morning and check out at 6 p.m. We don't expect you to do that. But if you can give us an hour or 2 hours, that's great, and we'd love for you to help out. We have snacks and food and conversations, and you'll meet friends, and it's really great and a very enjoyable time. And know that you're the backbone of the whole operation. So, wamc.org/volunteer to sign up and to help us out. We'll be mentioning this a couple times, but please do whatever you can do to help us, not only financially, but also volunteer. You are the lifeblood of this station, and we appreciate everything you do. Let me introduce our group to you. Terry Gibson was supposed to be with us, and then he had a pipe emergency and had to bail out. I think he actually is bailing out water from his house, but so had to literally bail out and is not with us today. So, but he'll be rescheduled, and we'll have Terry on soon. But we have two wonderful panelists this morning. Bill Hammond is here, senior fellow for health policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy. Good morning, Bill Hammond. How are you?
Good morning. And I one great advantage that you didn't mention of volunteering is you get to see the inside of the palatial WAMC studios.
Well, that's right.
And you may also bump into someone, you know, like a famous person in the hallway, and you could share that story with your friends and family.
You bring up a great point, Bill, which is currently the building is under construction, a refurbishing, a dust up, if you will. And so when you go in at the front where you normally would come in, it just looks like a bomb went off. It's much more organized than that, but you know, they know what they're doing, but it's just it's been leveled. So we're working on that. And so when you come in, you'll be immediately, I think, a little bit disoriented. And then as you start to walk back into then things get more normal and you get into the Pledge Central and it'll start to look like it has in the past. But it's very nice. And I think, but also to your point, I think you'll be walking into more people because there's only one hallway.
Yeah. Everybody has to use the same hallway.
That's right. We all have to share the hallway. Bill, thank you for being here. Kathy Sheehan joins us, former mayor of the city of Albany. Good morning, Mayor. How are you?
Good morning. And I had one of those celebrity sightings myself. I bumped into none other than Joe Donahue in the hallway.
There you go.
And there he was. It was, you know, it was a thrill.
People ask me all the time, what's Joe Donahue like?
Thank you. I normally I would ask, so and you said, but I won't do that.
I said he's just like he is on the air.
Yeah, well, that's okay. Yeah. That's good. That's fair. All right. Well, you know what? We were just talking as we were getting ready to go on today, and we figured that since we always talk about bad news, we thought we would talk about some local news and some good news and something that broke just about an hour ago, which is pretty exciting. And since we have someone in the studio who actually knows about it, we think, all right, well, let's do it. According to our friends at the Times Union, I'm going to read their coverage here. IBM says it plans a major expansion of its operation in Albany after the federal government awarded the company and GlobalFoundries a combined $1.375 billion in grants for quantum computing. How cool is that? IBM will receive a $1 billion grant, and GlobalFoundries, based in Saratoga County, will receive $375 million. The Wall Street Journal reported the development earlier Thursday. The money is part of $2 billion that the Trump administration is awarding to companies in the burgeoning quantum computer industry. IBM said in its own news release that the grant would be used, along with $1 billion in cash from the company, to build its own standalone quantum computing chip manufacturing company, or foundry, in Albany. It will be called Anderon. As if out of Marvel Comics.
Or the Old Testament. Or
Anderon. Yes, that's right. Well, so much of Marvel is out of the Old Testament. IBM makes all of the Nighthawk and Loom quantum computer chips at the Albany Nanotech Research Complex on Fuller Road. IBM is playing a major role in making the Capital Region the center of the quantum computing world. Former Mayor Sheehan.
So wait, can you say that last sentence again?
Yes.
Making Albany the center of the quantum
computing world.
Wow.
Well, you know, when you look at, and you know, this is where I feel like there are such cynics about what is really happening here in Albany.
Yeah.
And when you talk to people who are in this world, anywhere in the world, they know Albany. They know the Nano Center. They know what is going on there. My husband and I were in Egypt for the trip that I took after I was no longer mayor. And we met people who were in awe that we lived in Albany because they were in tech and they know, and in R&D, and they know Albany. RPI has a quantum computer, one of the only quantum computers at a university anywhere. And so this is an area that is known for the investment and the research that is happening there. And that is in no small part due to the work of Senator Schumer and Governor Hochul. They've invested billions of dollars in tech, and they are serious about it. And so when Trump became president and the brakes were halted on a lot of what was going on there, there was concern that this opportunity would somehow pass us by. But because of the hard work, because of the investment, and because the business community, companies like IBM, said, nope, this needs to happen, and this investment has to happen in Albany because of the prior investments that have already happened there, because of the researchers that are there, because of the investments that we've already made. Obviously, we're finding out today that that argument won the day, and we're seeing this really significant investment, and people should be paying attention, and we should be looking at other economic development opportunities to augment the investments that are being made.
When we talk about the dollar figure, it's huge, and it's obviously very impressive. And we think of quantum computing, and it is a great announcement for the average Albanian and someone living in the capital region. What do you think it means?
I think it means that we will see an influx of more people coming to the region to be adjacent to this technology. Those who I speak to who are in this world say that you will need to be near this technology, near this research and development, if you are adjacent to any of these economic opportunities that are posed by quantum computing. And so It means more people buying homes. It means more people patronizing our restaurants. It means growth for our region. And I think that it is a real opportunity. And so I think when you look at what is happening at the UAlbany campus, at the RPI campus, at the Nano campus, up in Saratoga, because this also includes funding for
Global Foundries.
Right. And then the corridor that Governor Hochul envisions of the basically the outline of the Erie Canal, but making that now all high tech. So the chip fab that's going in Syracuse will have an impact here. So these are all opportunities for us to grow and to take advantage of these opportunities.
I have two questions, and then I'll pass this over to Bill. But what is it about Albany? I mean, one of these things leads to the other, right? I mean, we've been talking about Tech Valley for 25, 30 years around here. So this has been a slow build.
Absolutely. But it demonstrates how you need to strategically make these investments to build to where we are today. And that has been very intentional. And it has resulted in this announcement today and you know, what we hope will be even more growth. I mean, the advantages that we have here are, first of all, proximity. We also have water. You know, we have a good transportation system.
Right.
And so we have a lot of things that we've built out that are benefits to this growth and that are helping to drive this growth. But it's also now the people that are entrenched. And I think that that's the thing that I do have the hardest time when I was mayor. How do you make that connection? Because so few people still understand what's going on at Nano. And that's where the collaborations with our high schools, with Tech Valley High that is located there and is probably going to have to move in order to make room for this, but where we do need to do a better job of ensuring that people at every level of education understand what that means for them with respect to job opportunities.
You identified yourself as a cynic.
I'm a cynic, but I'm also somebody who grew up in Albany, and so I'm glad to see, you know, good things happen here. I'm also a former reporter, and I covered a lot of this. I remember going to press conferences out at what became, whatever it's called, the College of Nano.
Now it's New York Creates, but it's part
really?
Of UAlbany.
Oh, okay.
Yes,
but like, or whatever it was.
If I remember correctly, this press conference may have involved like President Obama and Joe Bruno Joe Bruno still around? Anyway,
we were in a clean room.
This goes. You were there too.
I was there.
But this goes back, I'm going to say 20 years, yes. 25 years. And like when they put money into the Global Foundries thing up in Malta, that was like an unprecedented amount of government subsidy for a tech project. I think it was in the neighborhood of $1 billion. I will say I now live up in Saratoga. The Malta area has been completely transformed. There's housing projects. There's new infrastructure, there's retail, there's a whole campus that surrounds the Global Foundry plant, all of which is just chock full of highly trained and highly educated employees, all of whom have moved to this area. I will say they're mostly in the kind of Malta, Clifton Park, Half
right.
Moon area. And so if something like that's going to happen in Greater Albany, that's a great thing. You do have to be really alert because it's money coming from government. It's money that's controlled by politicians. You have to be really alert for corruption. I mean that did become a problem at the with Elaine Calieros.
Right.
He was like the mastermind of a lot of what happened. Especially at the Nanotech campus, and eventually got convicted.
Well,
but like all that said, it does seem like all of that money is starting. Well, it's gradually paying off. I mean, you can't drive by the Nanotech campus and not see just what like it just looks like an amazing facility from the outside, and I'm sure it's an amazing facility on the
inside
as well.
And I understand the cynics around, you know, this investment, and $1 billion could be go towards affordable housing. It could go towards a lot of things. But the CHIPS and Science Act is there. It's funded.
It's slush fund for them.
And we want the funding. We want investment in the Capital Region. I think it's interesting, though, to your point, that this money is now going directly to IBM and Global Foundries. And so it'll be interesting to see what the sort of hooks are that and the requirements around how they invest this money and, you know, what that looks like here in the Capital Region, in Poughkeepsie, and in New York State. But again, it would not be happening if it were not for these investments that have happened, yes, over two decades, that have resulted in this being a premier research and development center that is known literally throughout the world.
We'll take a break. We'll come back and talk more. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be back right after this.
Support comes from Harrington's Lumber Millwork and Building Supplies, decking, stone, and tile specialists offering TimberTech decking and railing, landscaping stone, and porcelain tile pavers for outdoor living spaces. Design services available. Harringtons.com.
Hi, this is Beth Jones from Third Eye Associates, and we've been underwriting WAMC for about 20 years now. We just feel like we're part of the community here. Our focus in our business is all around community, so we feel like WAMC really gets the job done. We do see our relationship with WAMC as a partnership. You know, the programming is phenomenal and it brings in the right people. So we're helping support AMC, and we think it's important to support public radio. And I think radio is a really good medium.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And we always welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org and wamc.org, to help the lockbox in any way, shape, or form. We certainly welcome you, panel@wamc.org. All right, let's move on to other things, and we see what else is happening in our world. So we've been talking about this most of the week, and that is the question of the constitutional limits is the latest wrinkle in the $1.8 billion fund that Donald Trump has set up, the deal the president has reached with his own subordinates relies on a mechanism created by Congress that legal experts had warned was subject to manipulation. This from the New York Times. In January, on a flight to his Florida club, Mar-a-Lago, President Trump mused about his $10 billion lawsuit against the IRS. "I'm supposed to work out a settlement with myself," he said. Mr. Trump is a tough negotiator, and looking in the mirror, he faced an equally tenacious adversary, but the president managed to work out a deal with himself on Monday, one as novel and brazen as the process that spawned it. He dropped the lawsuit, extracting from his own government a promise to create a $1.8 billion fund to dole out to his political allies. A day later, in a curious addendum, Todd Blanche, Mr. Trump's former lawyer and the acting attorney general, purported to immunize him from lawsuits arising from a great many things, not least his tax liabilities. "The government of the United States," Mr. Blanche wrote, "is, quote, forever barred and precluded from pursuing claims against Mr. Trump involving lawfare and or weaponization or tax returns. The whole enterprise was a jarring shock to the conventional understanding of the constitutional system, raising what legal experts said were profound questions about presidential power. If the arrangement is allowed to stand, they say, Mr. Trump will have managed simultaneously to thwart Congress's power of the purse and the ability of the courts to police the separation of powers. Indeed, Tuesday's addendum flirted with a grave question with no settled answer. Can the president pardon himself? A lot going on here, and this continues to go on. One thing I have to say is it seemed initially maybe the story would sort of evaporate a little bit, and that has not happened, and I think that is good, because even Republicans, as I mentioned yesterday, John Thune and others, standing up and saying, okay, we have to take a very, very close look at this. Mayor Sheehan.
Well, I think it's interesting that Trump has been quoted as saying that one of his biggest concerns is going to prison. And it is something that he articulated, you know, years and years ago. But it is definitely something that, at least in what I've read and what has been reported, has been a concern of his. And so when you look at the sweeping breadth of the waiver that has been signed by Todd Blanch, it includes any matters currently pending or that could be pending, including tax returns filed before the effective date, before the defendants or agencies or other agencies or departments. So it's sweeping. This isn't just tax returns. This is anything and everything that could or could be pending. So, you know, this is his get out of jail free card. This has got to probably allow him to really sleep well at night, knowing the breadth of this. Now he just has to not break the law post the date of this settlement agreement. It's horrifying. I mean, let's just say what it is. It is absolutely unprecedented. It is unwarranted. And it is indicative of the fact that this individual believes that he has complete and total power to do whatever he wants. And that is not the foundation of this country. We never wanted to put this much power in the hands of anyone. And this should not stand. But we have a Congress that I have no faith will do anything to put roadblocks in the way for this.
Bill Hammond.
So our Constitution has these so-called system of checks and balances, and it's precisely because the designers of it, the framers, they anticipated that things like this would happen, that people would use their power granted to them by the Constitution in malign ways. And so the other branches of government were there to step in and prevent that from happening. That system depends on two things. It depends the existence of this settlement fund, which is a pot of money. It's an unlimited pot of money that's used by the federal government to settle civil litigation and to pay out damages when that happens. It's unlimited because it was a hassle for Congress to have to prove individual settlements. The existence of that fund sort of took for granted that presidents would use it responsibly. I shouldn't say presidents, but the Department of Justice would use it responsibly, and the president wouldn't even be involved, right? It would just be the Department of Justice, which is supposed to have a certain distance from the president, would handle the money responsibly. That was a norm. That's one of the norms that's being violated. But then when that norm is violated, the other branches of government are supposed to step in. And Congress is the first line of defense. They should be coming in and saying, no, you can't use this money that way. They could vote to cut it off right away. It would require a majority vote. Maybe it would be subject to a veto. But like if they showed a spine, if they, you know, fulfilled their constitutional duties, they could shut this down.
I'm gonna,
and then this,
I'm going to hold you there because I want to get we have a break, and I also just want to give you your due time here to talk about this, because so we'll bookmark that and we'll come right back and talk about it. We're going to go over to Pledge Central and hear from Sarah and Ray. Top of the hour stuff. We'll be back right after this. Music from Julius Rodriguez this morning. Playlist online, WAMC.org/roundtable. Good morning, all. Welcome back to the roundtable panel. With us this morning, we have former mayor of the city of Albany, Kathy Sheehan, and senior fellow for health policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Bill Hammond. As we were going to break, Bill was making a very good point, and so I
a lengthy point.
I want to go right back. That's not your fault. That was me. I brought you down a path and didn't realize that we were so close in time. But I will say that you were bringing us to this point of, okay, so all of this happens, and then Congress responds by not responding and just crickets. So that leaves it to the courts?
So he's the president is ignoring norms. He's blowing past all of the normal understanding of how the Constitution is supposed to work and what the law says. He's going into completely uncharted territory. And the answer to that that's built into the Constitution is for one of the other branches to step up. Congress is not stepping up. There's still a chance that they will at some point, but ultimately, all of this is going to land in the courts. And I think there's at least a reasonable chance that the courts will look at this and they will just be offended and they'll find a way. I think there are plenty of good arguments that this is sort of plainly, flatly, and obviously outside the bounds of what a president can do, and they will shut it down. But that's not guaranteed. That depends on what's going on inside the head of you know, nine justices, a lot of whom were appointed by the president and might share his worldview. But I don't think actually that even a very conservative, like Federalist Society, Trump-friendly justice is going to approve of this kind of just manhandling of the Constitution.
Is that short-term or long-term? In the meaning, is this going to have to wind its way through the courts slowly, or is it something that they can take action on right away?
It has to wind. I mean, the normal course of events is you have to start at the lowest level of court and then the mid-level appeal, and then
right.
It has to go. And also, I guess there's a question of who would have standing. Eventually someone will have standing, and someone will apply for funding and not get it or something like that, and somebody will have standing.
Meanwhile, police officers at the Capitol on January 6th are already suing to block the DOJ payout fund. So those lawsuits have already begun. The fund violates federal law and would legitimize political violence, according to two officers who make their arguments in this known challenge.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this president has demonstrated the danger that he presents to law enforcement and to really, quite candidly, all Americans by his willingness to pardon people who clearly committed acts of violence and broke the law. This is not a question of, to me, being persecuted or weaponized. For the individuals who the Trump has pardoned thus far, they are individuals who were tried in court by juries, most of them, and were found to have broken the law. And whether that's fraudsters that he has pardoned or people who committed acts of violence, and he has taken the position that if you commit illegal acts, if you break the law, but you're on my side, I have your back. And now not only do I have your back in that I'm going to erase your criminal record, but I'm going to give you cash money. At a time, I mean, you know, we're reading about people who can't afford health care. We're reading about people who are losing their homes, who are struggling to put gas in their car. And we haven't set up a $1.8 billion fund for them. We haven't set up a $1.8 billion fund for people who are dealing with an affordability crisis in many ways driven by redlining that the government perpetrated. We aren't talking about helping average Americans at all. This is a priority of this president, and it demonstrates to me how completely out of touch he is with working Americans and the struggles of everyday life that people are dealing with right now.
One of the things that we have a letter from a listener, and it says, for lawyers and legal scholars, the next logical question is whether this action can bind future administrations and future Congresses. Is it like an executive order which has a limited lifespan, or is it more like an immunity deal between a prosecutor and a citizen which has to be honored forever?
Yes. I mean, once something like this is signed, if it's a settlement agreement. Now, the interesting thing about this, and this is where it gets dangerous because I'm a former lawyer. But because they have not asked the judge, as a matter of fact, they've explicitly told the judge, no, we don't need you to be involved in this settlement agreement. But I do believe it is a legal binding document. But typically you would have a judge that would sign off on a settlement in order to dismiss a case. And there have been times when federal judges have said no, that they are not going to sign off on certain settlement agreements.
So that, I mean I'm not even a former lawyer. I'm not a lawyer of any kind, but I'm the son of a lawyer. That's a question. Like, I'm curious to see what that judge will do. Having been told that he's not involved in the case, he was in the middle of demanding evidence or some kind of documents from both sides, the two sides both being the Trump administration, when they cut him off. And I guess I'm wondering, has he agreed that he's out of this, or is he going to assert that he's not out of it? That could be an avenue for this to be shut down. But with respect to the officers who sued, the two, one was a Washington officer, one was a Capitol officer. As sympathetic as I am to their cause, I don't see how they have an angle to sue. Like, they're not involved in this fund at all, and they're sort of taking for granted that the fund is going to compensate people involved on January 6th, and that hasn't been determined yet.
Right.
But I think this is where, I feel that there are so many institutions that have sold out to Trump, because every police union in the country should have, first of all, protested the pardoning of these individuals, much less now setting up a fund to give them money. I look at the business community. It's not just Congress that's silent, and shame on Congress, shame on the Republicans in Congress. And people write in and say, how do you change that? The only way to change it is electorally right now. That's it. That's our only path, is to flip the House and the Senate, and that's looking less and less likely. So strap on your seatbelt, because I think we're going to get two more years of this insanity. But I look at the business community. I look at law enforcement. I look at all of the various I look at the healthcare industry. The healthcare industry is being impacted by the fact that people are no longer insured. You know, that is going to raise the number of people who are getting care and aren't able to pay for it, which impacts the health of our healthcare industry. All of these institutions are silent. And that is what is so infuriating to me. And that is the fear of this administration by doing things like this. You look at what they've done with the media, with really the law firms, the way that this administration has been able to silence everyone is what is infuriating to me. And that is, to me, where we need braver souls, right? We need profiles in courage, because we are on a very, to me, deep, dark path at this point in time.
It's interesting because I think some of what you're talking about, Kathy, is fear. Like, we've just seen where a couple of Republicans, Senator Kennedy from Louisiana, am I getting this right, Kennedy? And then Massey, and then
the endorsement of Paxton.
Where if you say anything or do anything that runs up against the Trump agenda as a Republican, he's going to come after you politically and he's going to support your opponent. So that's fear. There's an element of fear that definitely is playing a role in how Congress is handling this. But I think there's also a cultural, or I'm not sure how you want to characterize it, but there's just enormous admiration and affection for Trump in the country. I don't think we can deny that. And it happens to be common among law enforcement people and the military. And so they're not inclined to speak up on this because they agree with him, or at least they sympathize with the president. As odd as that may seem to us on the outside of that world, you would think their first loyalty would be to their fellow officers who were abused in the course of doing their jobs. But the thing is, a lot of those January 6 people probably had connections to law enforcement. So, like, I don't think it's all about fear. I think it's ordinary human, like, that's their political alliance and they're on board.
I agree with you completely. I do think, however, that there was something happened from Monday to Tuesday, and I don't know what it means. But Monday, the coverage was about the agreement, and once the agreement happened, everybody, certainly at Fox and on the right, were saying, This does not benefit the president at all. This does not put any money into his pockets. He is doing this for the goodness of others. He is doing this for those who have been abused by the system. He is doing this for those. And I agree. I think that was the sentiment in law enforcement and elsewhere, that, look, this is somebody who's on our side. Then the addendum comes in, and then you realize, oh, okay, so this is this is how you're going to make the money off of it.
Well, I do think, like, every time he does something outrageous that annoys people on the left, that annoys me, although I don't consider myself on the left, but every time he does something outrageous, he erodes his base of support. And it's not always necessarily visible right away, but people kind of peel away. They become alienated. I've seen interviews with, like, fundamentalist Christians who are like, you know, I didn't appreciate him depicting himself as Christ. You know, right. Like that was a bridge too far for that person. And I think he is crossing so many bridges, and he's gone so far from what's normal and acceptable in the country. And every time he does that, I mean, maybe sometimes he picks up support, but he's also alienating people. It shows up in the polls. His approval ratings are as low as they could be. All of the signs are that the midterms are going to be a blue wave. These primary victories are a commentary on what hardcore activist Republicans turn out in primaries. That's their sentiment is pro-Trump. That's clear. But the country as a whole is not on board.
But the way that redistricting works and the way that these lines have been drawn, it makes it very difficult for there to be a blue wave. And so when you look at who votes, who shows up, and what happens in midterm elections, it is a very, very difficult political map for Democrats, for change. And this administration, again, through bullying, through to me out and out grift, has silenced so many who would otherwise be potentially funding Democrats in their campaigns, would be contributing politically to Democrats, so that we can flip the House and the Senate. And many, many, many of those voices have been silenced, or, you know, they're staying on the sidelines. And so, you know, that's what I say when I mean profiles and courage. There are some who are willing to be able to benefit financially from this president, you know, jump onto the grift. And the average American is the one that's being harmed here.
So we have a few minutes before break. I want to just ask a follow-up question, Kathy, because you just made my spine sweat, which is... the blue wave. I mean, a month ago, that was a done deal. Like, in... Everyone was talking about it as if it was, you know, there's no way. And I mean, even Trump, when he was going out, he was like, look, you know, if you don't do something, they're going to impeach me. And that has changed dramatically in the last 2 weeks with court decisions and what we have seen take place in a number of states. And I guess the jury is still out as to what's going to happen, because a lot more action can take place. But it's going to be very complicated.
Well, I think that there's also such a high level of distrust with respect to the electoral process, and that there are states that are choosing to make it far more difficult for people to vote. There's still the desire of this president to change the law nationally, which I think would throw even more confusion into the process. And what a lot of that does to people is it disenfranchises them. You know, those of us who sit on this show, and many of your listeners are people who can't imagine not voting, but we are not the majority, unfortunately. And there are folks who feel very disempowered by what they see going on. And I worry that they choose to stay home. I worry that they're fearful about going to the polls in certain places. And so, you know, we think about in New York, we're kind of in this bubble. But I talk to people across the country where violence is threatened. People get worried. We have to have these briefings, as when I was a mayor, about the fact that, you know, no militias are not, self-formed militias cannot show up at polling places with guns. But these are all things that happen. So voter intimidation is a real thing. And I think that there are really deep concerns about not only now the electoral maps now swinging completely in the direction of conservatives, but and the right, but also all of the things that could come in November with respect to voter intimidation and outright, disenfranchisement.
So I agree that these decisions about gerrymandering generally, they sort of changed the board. They work to the disadvantage of Democrats. I mean, I haven't dug into it deeply, but I believe there, in order for the Democrats to win Congress, they had to, I forget what the ratio is, but like in order to get 51% of seats in Congress, they needed to have 53% of the vote or something like that. And now maybe that's, instead of 53, it's 54, 55% of the vote. So these decisions made it more challenging. On the other hand, if you take gerrymandering too far, you dilute, like if you're a Republican trying to gerrymander, the way you create more Republican districts is by splitting up a Democratic district and distributing those Democrats into Republican districts. Well, that makes those districts somewhat more purple. It might put them, if there is a wave of sentiment against the Republican Party, you might see some of those districts that were designed to elect a Republican, you might see them go the other way. So gerrymandering can backfire on the party that does it. I guess the answer, though, is for Democrats to do a good job in this campaign, to put up strong candidates, to have a strong message, to present themselves as a party that is competent and capable and connected to the issues that matter to ordinary people, to voters. And then to get people to the polls, to do things, you know, to be a well-organized and competent party. I think they'll have plenty of money. I think they're like, I don't think that people are being cowed into not donating money to the Democratic Party. The Republicans will have plenty of money too. It's going to be a very expensive election. But I don't think like there should be a sense of defeatism. I think it's, you know, the election is very much like the fundamentals of what the president's approval rating looks like, and the fact that midterms almost always go to the opposition party. I don't see any of that fundamentally changing.
And as far as the, I mean, obviously there was a point of saying, well, you know, we got the Democrats have the House in the bag, and then maybe the Senate looks. And I mean, just getting back to our conversation about what we've been seeing in the primaries and trying to read those tea leaves, and the even with what is going on, even with we had a panelist yesterday make a really good point. I thought it was a good question, which is, you know, all of the support that and loyalty that the politicians are giving Donald Trump and endorsing them and moving them forward, which does seem to be paying off, at least in the short term, also comes at a time when this guy has the lowest approval rating of his presidency. However, of course, not within the party and not within Republicans.
Right. And I think that's where the cynicism tends to grow, is that, you know, if you looked at polling, he wouldn't be president. And so I think there's some cynicism about the accuracy of the polling and what that's really going to mean district by district across this country. And again, those of us in New York and in the Northeast in general, I think have a skewed view of the difficulties that are presented in other places, the messaging that is happening in other places. And yes, I think that when you look at the failures of the Democratic Party to demonstrate that and to be effective in demonstrating that they are able to lead, and that they are able to lead effectively, and that they have an alternative, is incredibly challenging. I mean, I just look at, you know, setting President Biden's mental capacity and aging issues aside. You know, this is a president who, through the CHIPS and Science Act, through the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, and through the American Rescue Plan, literally invested trillions of dollars across the economy. We saw wages grow. You know, we saw inflation start to come down and then eventually come down, and huge benefits. I mean, if you look across the city of Albany, you know, and you're pointing to investments that have been made in the last 5 years, many of them I can point to and say that was because of the American Rescue Plan. That was because of the CHIPS and Science Act. That was because of the infrastructure bill. And so, notwithstanding that, you know, the Democrats have not been able to be successful, and they do need a very simple, straightforward message about what this election really means for our country.
We'll take a break. We'll wrap up the show on the other side of a news break. We welcome you to help out the Lockbox, WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our special Lockbox edition of the roundtable. Normally, we would have had a break, but they're taping the media project, so we're going to have that break at 10:50 this morning to hear from Sarah and Ray about the importance of filling the lockbox. So please, whatever you can do, WAMC.org, WAMC.org. We have a wonderful group of volunteers on the phones, ready to go, 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC. You are vital to the equation. You are a central part of the equation, and we cannot continue without you. And we thank you so much for what you have done and what you will continue to do. So given that we have 15 or 17 minutes left, let's talk, continue on where we were on this issue. When it comes to, I guess, electorally, coming up, midterms, beyond.
Well, this is actually kind of a longer term point I wanted to make, and that is that there's another kind of gerrymandering going on, and it's the gerrymandering that consists of people voting with their feet. And if you look at population patterns in this country, New York is losing population, or its population is stagnant. California also. These are the two largest blue states, whereas Texas and Florida and other red states are growing. And that means that those states are going to have more seats in Congress and more seats in the Electoral College. And that's going to present a greater challenge for the Democrats in future elections. Now, why would people be doing that? Why would people be moving from New York to Texas or New York to Florida? It's largely because of economic opportunity. Those states have more vibrant economies. They're creating more jobs. There's more economic development generally going on there. And so people move there because that's where the jobs are. And I think that's something that Democrats need to address, right? Like, if they want a long-term future as a viable party in this country, they need to figure out a way for their states to be have more vibrant economies and be places where people want to live and vote. And that's not going to fix anything in 2026, but I do think it's something that Democrats should reflect on. And, like, you know, the way they're running New York, states like New York and California, is not like, it's driving people away instead of pulling people in. And that is kind of a long-term issue for them.
Oh, Mayor.
You know, I think that when you look at, first of all, you know, shifting to Florida, and a lot of folks retire to Florida. You know, to me, when you look at the economic opportunity that exists, it's to me, that's not necessarily the compelling reason. I think it's more cost of living here, and the cost of living in New York State is undoubtedly very high. And when you have this affordability crisis that we're in right now, it makes it even more challenging for folks to make ends meet here. Housing is more expensive, but many of the things that drive cost in New York State are also things that make this state a place that has clean water, that is focused on sustainability, that is focused on safety. And so And it is also a state that is very supportive of organized labor, which tends to drive up wages, not drag them down. And so we also have abundant resources. We have an abundance. I say it all the time. We have an abundance of water. You know, we are a place where, when you think about the ability to invest, we have a highly educated population. There are a lot of positives around New York State, and I agree, we have to figure out how do we jettison the things that are dragging us down and lift up the things that are real assets to being in New York State.
Yeah, no question.
All right, we have, I think, time for one more topic, so let's go there this morning. And as always, we welcome your letters, panel at wamc.org, panel at wamc.org. I am wondering if we should, maybe we should go to letters. Yes, let's do that. I didn't realize quite how many we have on the ballot here. some of these go all the way back to the slush fund conversation, but we'll go through them quick. One is Teresa says, can we just say it? Racism. And yes, there's plenty of it in law enforcement as well. Then we go to Kevin. The first people to file a weaponization claim should be the Georgia election workers. Do it. Make it very public. Accountability matters more than anything. Andrew, I would love to hear Mayor Sheehan weigh in on the premise that the party of Trump and their Project 2025 backers have already rigged the vote, whether by gerrymandering, restricting the vote, or taking advantage those less educated to figure it out so much in their favor that the Democrats actually have no chance for overtaking any branch of government in 2026 or 2028. Is there really anything left that can be done? I asked that question in a version which you answered, but if there's anything else you want to add.
No, I think that it does demonstrate how important it is going to be for Democrats to be incredibly intentional and take all of this has all been rigged against the Democrats, and the Democrats need to not look at people who are coming out and protesting and rallying, but they really need to count the votes and get people to the polls. That is going to be critical across this country.
We go to Tom. As a retired state trooper, I have been appalled since 2016 when Trump was first elected at the cowardice, silence, and gleeful support for this criminal in the White House. Yes, a large percentage of cops are on the political right, but not all. Yet very few of my former colleagues are standing up. The support and endorsement of Trump by FOPs, Federation of Police, is that what that is? And police unions is pathetic. How do you not condemn a convicted felon for the open criminality of this administration? Cops tend to be physically brave people, but moral cowardice within policing is as prevalent as in the rest of society. We really need... Go ahead.
I think, like, of course there are police on all sides of the political spectrum, but which party is the one that is most likely to come down like a ton of bricks on a cop? Like, I mean, there are times when police do something wrong and they get away with it, and that's bad. But there are other times when the police do something right and they're criticized for how they've handled the situation and pilloried. And so, I mean, I think the alienation between the left and police kind of goes both ways. And I think it's a tricky thing because police do need to be held accountable, and the tendency among Democrats to always kind of favor union rights is one reason why the police are immune from accountability sometimes. But I think the left has gone through kind of a paroxysm of criticizing cops over the past 5-10 years, and that police have taken that to heart, and the Democrats in some cases had good reasons for that paroxysm, but I think the police are correctly reading which party is more likely to have their backs when they get into trouble.
Well, I think, you know, that's a broader conversation that could be an entire show, right?
Yes.
Law enforcement, creating trust. And I think that certainly there are folks on both sides of the political spectrum that have very different views on this. But I think when you look at creating accountability and trust with the police, having police have legitimacy in the community makes everyone safer. And I have tremendous respect for our police officers. And I have always said, I have been protested. I have had people show up at my state of the city and not allow me to speak because I wouldn't fire police officers. Because I always took the position that if a police officer did what we trained them to do, then we must support them. And if we don't like what they're doing, then we need to look at the training. We need to look at what we are expecting of our police officers. We need to look at the support and the tools that we're providing them. But I think when you look at the flagrant violence that happened before our eyes. Police officers injured, people who were there to protect our country injured, having bear spray sprayed in their face, being beaten with poles, and to have every single one of those individuals was pardoned. It's abhorrent, and I have far more respect for law enforcement than that action to me demonstrated.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll take another question or two, and then we'll wrap up for this episode of the Roundtable Panel. We'll be right back after this. I like the letters that come in that are just sort of having to do with nothing that we've been discussing and yet have everything to do with what we've been discussing. C writes, I'm just wondering if any of you can understand what is happening in the stock market. It makes no sense to me why it keeps going up. Every time Trump promises something they know just isn't true. If anyone can explain this to me, I would certainly appreciate it. We've asked this question a lot on this program, and I don't think we've had a satisfactory answer.
I think so. Part of it is, I'm going to present myself as an expert now, but I'm absolutely not an expert. And past results don't predict future results. your results may vary. I have heard people who do know about this talk about it. One thing is that, like, the economic fundamentals haven't, like, things have kind of corroded, but a lot of the economic fundamentals are still pretty strong in the U.S., especially compared to other countries. You know, the Gulf of Hormuz could change that, but for now, things are still strong. But the other thing that's just kind of underneath a lot of what's going on in the stock market is the AI bubble.
Right.
Or it's either a bubble or it's a revolution. There's just an enormous amount of enthusiasm about that. They see that as like the world-changing technology of our day. It's like, you know, the telephone or something. There's so much enthusiasm about that, and there's so much money flowing into it, and people are betting on it. They don't really care, like, what happens to the Constitution or the democracy. Like, that's secondary to the excitement about AI.
But I think that, you also hear people say all the time, the stock market is not the economy.
Right.
And we have the widest wealth gap in our history. I believe we have surpassed the wealth gap back in the robber baron days. I may be wrong on that. Somebody can correct me. And so we have seen the wealthy become mega wealthy, right? And so you have literally trillions of dollars that need a place to go. And so I think that we're also seeing, again, that widening gap, but where you are seeing these investments, and we're seeing SpaceX is going public and is probably going to create the first trillionaire. But, you know, we're talking about a very, very, very small percentage of our population that is in any way, shape, or form benefiting from the performance of the stock market.
Well,
my New York State pension, sure, but I mean, this is not something that is benefiting the average American who's trying to figure out how to fill their gas tank.
We're just about out of time, but I just want to, for the record, say that Bill's left eyebrow shot into the air.
She anticipated what I was going to say.
I thank you both so much for being here and sharing your thoughts with us. You're both wonderful, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Be well. We're going to go over to Pledge Central and our pledge desk, if you will, and check in with – how's the desk? Check in with Ray and Sarah, and they have all kinds of things to tell you about in regards to the lockbox. We will do that and continue with the roundtable right after this.